but the market off its record highs hit in September and some sectors in correction. Paying attention to the technicals really matters at the moment. Let's dive into this one. Liz Young, SoFi Head of Investment Strategy. Liz, always good to see you here. So from a technical standpoint, what are the markets telling you right now?
Well, what the markets are telling us right now is that we don't have to be as worried as we were mid to late summer about waiting for a correction, right? So now we've got a correction in a decent amount of sectors. We've got a decent amount of sectors trading below their 50-day moving averages. So it tells you that things aren't as frothy as they were earlier this year. And I think that that's a positive. What you think about then afterwards is, okay, does that mean from a technical perspective, it's sending a signal that there's more room to go down? It's possible that there is, but I always like to remind people a correction or a pullback absent a recession is usually a buying opportunity. So I think there's actually some good chance that these sectors that have corrected over recent months could bounce back into the end of the year.
Interesting. So there are some other notes to that effect this morning from the likes of Goldman and J.P. Morgan, as we were talking about a few minutes ago. When we look at the underlying fundamental drivers of the market right now and this whole view that we are still seeing persistent inflation, as we go into earnings season, how are you thinking about cost inputs in earnings reports and how much of an obstacle that's going to be? Or are we going to see price increases that make up for it?
Yeah, I'm going to take that in two parts. So there's economic fundamentals and then there's corporate fundamentals. And we're actually seeing a softening in both. But I think the economic fundamentals remain strong. It's just that the momentum behind them has maybe slowed down a bit. So we're seeing some misses in the economic data. We obviously had a little bit of mixed results in the jobs data from Friday. I do think inflation continues to be persistent through the end of this year and into 2022. The question really is, what does transitory mean? What does transient mean? I think what the Fed is defining that as is an inflation force that basically fixes itself. So over time, the Fed won't have to intervene to change the inflation trajectory, that it will soften on its own. But then the question about corporate fundamentals comes in when, how much is that going to pressure corporations if we continue to see inflation for the next 6 months? And the answer is that it's already pressuring corporations. Now, companies that have strong pricing power, that have a strong competitive position, are able to pass those costs through onto consumers. And as we continue to see wage growth, consumers should be able to absorb it. I think the real risk here is that you can't pass through labor shortages. And that's what we're going to see in some of these earnings results in Q3. I think we're going to be surprised that things aren't nearly as strong as they have been in previous quarters as far as earnings go. But we'll see how many companies have been able to pass through those increased costs.
Liz, you think we're dealing with stagflation right now?
No, I don't think we're dealing with it right now, because if you look at growth numbers, I mean, we're still above 4%, 5% for a lot of estimates in the United States, which is strong growth for the most developed economy. Long run growth trend is about 2%. So we're still growing above trend. So I wouldn't define that as stagflation. There is a fear that stagflation could become a problem in 2022 as growth slows and as inflation maybe doesn't relax as quickly as we hope. Then there's an issue because the Fed can't really do both at the same time. They have to choose which problem to solve. Do they want to stimulate growth or do they want to control inflation? And those are usually opposite tools to use.
Well, something else, another technical indicator, of course, that you talk about in your most recent note is volatility, which is probably what's going to result as there's this tension, right? As people try to figure out which of these narratives is going to be correct. How should investors be thinking about volatility right now and how to kind of ride it out?
Well, look, I think, you know, in August, everybody was saying fall could be a volatile season. Fall is seasonally a volatile time of year. This fall has been no exception. So we've clearly seen some bumps in the road through September. We're continuing to see that in October. Volatility is something, again, it's normal in a market to experience volatility. I think right now what's happening is something very similar to what happened in spring, where we saw a volatile period, and it was actually just characteristic of a rotation taking place. And then for the following 3 months, we saw different parts of the market lead. So I think this volatile period is that rotation back into cyclicals, and we should see the cyclicals and the reopen stocks do well through the end of the year. But transitions are not usually smooth. This is a bumpy one. And I think we continue to see bumps as we get more volatile news out of Washington, as we have more question marks about what's going to happen with the debt ceiling and the reconciliation bill. So unfortunately, I don't think this volatility is going anywhere anytime soon. But I also don't think that it's the canary in the coal mine of a huge bear market.
One could really go down the rabbit hole, Liz, when it comes to technical analysis, drawing all sorts of shapes on charts, what have you. What's the most important technical measure you're watching right now, and why?
Look, so first of all, technical analysis is an input. It shouldn't be a major decision factor. There are a lot of day traders that use technical analysis to rotate in and out of positions, and that's something that I think is reserved for those day traders. Technicals are something that you can look at for giving you an indicator of timing, deciding on when to enter or exit a position. But if you're a long-term investor, technicals, again, are just an input, not a major decision factor. What I would be watching in this market is volume, and I did talk about that in the recent piece as well, and just the trend. So the things that you can watch for: how strong is the trend? Is the trend reversing? Can we confirm the trend? So I talked about moving averages in that piece. You can pair that with volume to decide whether or not this trend is strong. So when you're seeing certain sectors, or you're seeing indices drop below their moving averages, when you're seeing a 50-day moving average drop below a 100-day moving average, that's a pretty strong recent trend. Sometimes that can mean that there's a bounce back coming. So I'd be watching the moving averages, I'd be watching volume, how much activity is happening under the surface, and those are things that drive not only volatility, but they drive the decision whether or not this trend is something that is getting a little bit long in the tooth and that we're expecting to see come out on the other side.
Just quickly, Liz, as we talk about trends, I'm curious about some of the recent trends in specific groups, especially going to earnings. We've seen energy doing really well. We've seen financials doing very well going into the earnings season. Do you think that that optimism is going to be realized as we start to get the numbers?
Well, the strength in energy has been driven by supply side issues, right? So there's been a pretty big squeeze on supply, continued increased demand. Now, energy prices have run up very, very quickly, and a lot of times people look at energy prices as an indicator that we could be headed for an issue in the market. I think that there is probably a level, or let's call it around the $90 mark, where markets start to get a little trepidatious and don't like energy prices being that high. It's just another input into that inflation story as well. Financials have done well because we've seen an opportunity for them to make more net interest margin. Now, this week we're kicking off earnings season with a lot of the big bank earnings. I think we're going to get more clarity on how much of their earnings have been driven by that rise in yields. And more importantly, you want to hear guidance from the financials. You want to hear about how much they plan to lend, how they're feeling about what their consumers are spending, and what their outlook is for things like trading. We've had, obviously, a long time of a lot of activity in the equity market, a lot of interest in the equity market. I'm interested to hear from some of those financials on what their trading revenue is going to look like going forward.
Always great perspective. Liz Young, SoFi Head of Investment Strategy. We'll talk with you soon. Big call over at Cowen on Airbnb. The team there upgraded their rating to outperform and slapped the stock with a $220 price target, up from $160 previously. Cowen analyst Kevin Koppelman joins us for our call of the day. Kevin, really good note here by you and your team. Take us through it. Why are you bullish on Airbnb?
Thanks a lot. Good to be here. So what we're seeing here is that alternative accommodations, which Airbnb is leading, has had an unprecedented growth in the lodging mix during the pandemic. And what we found from our work is that we believe the step up of alternative accommodations is going to be a permanent shift. So you're not going to see a reversion back away from alternative towards hotels during the recovery. Instead, you're going to see Airbnb and others in the space continue to show strength in the coming years, and that was really the driver behind this upgrade today.
Kevin, it's Julie here. What gives you that confidence? Have you seen a commensurate decline that's persisted in hotel traffic, for example? I think some people certainly miss the sort of more full service that hotels provide, but a lot of people like just going, being able to be in a house or what have you. So what are the data points or what's the evidence that you're seeing out there?
So there are a couple of indicators. First is just the results that Airbnb and others are putting up. So we saw the initial shift towards vacation rentals, an alternative in 2020. And then in 2021, that has only continued. And so we estimate that alternative accommodations have gone from about 24% of lodging dollars globally prior to the pandemic up to about 33% today. The second one is we have a proprietary tracking survey that we do of U.S. consumers. And what we found, we asked them, where are you planning to stay in the coming year? And what we found is that expectations for short-term rental usage over the next year are near an all-time high. So what travelers are saying is, yes, we know we've been taking these trips to homes over the past year, but we're going to do even more of that in the coming year. Now, I want to make sure I point something out. So we don't think this is doomsday for hotels by any mean. We're pretty bullish on the overall travel recovery. And we also think that travelers are going to be going to hotels more. So there's an increase in alternative in the mix, but hotels will also be growing along with that.
Kevin, what's the setup on Airbnb into earnings here? How much do you expect the company to show in terms of bookings growth? And do you think they'll beat?
Yeah, look, so the company's been putting up strong numbers since they've been public. They've been beating by about the gross booking side by about 20%. Their category is stronger seasonally earlier in the year. That being said, we know that in September, after the current COVID-19 wave started to subside, that travel bookings have been picking up. So they've said that to expect gross booking value would be down a little bit Q over Q. So we'll see. We have it just down just a hair Q over Q. Looking longer term, what we published today with our five-year projections, we have Airbnb gross bookings growing over two and a half times between this year and 5 years from now, up to $126 billion. And perhaps even more importantly, we have their EBITDA growing about five times from $1.5 billion or so this year to $8 billion in 2026. So we think those numbers over the next couple of years are going to be pretty shocking, and we're significantly above street consensus at the moment.
And Kevin, when we think about competition for Airbnb, I mean, I was trying to think off the top of my head, you have Vrbo, you have some of the big hotel companies that have been getting into this space a little bit. You have something like Asander, which is sort of a hotel Airbnb hybrid. In your view, does anyone really stand a chance of chipping away at Airbnb's what seems to be a pretty commanding market lead?
Look, there are three key competitors to think about. First, the direct competitors are Booking Holdings and Expedia, which owns Vrbo in the United States. And what we found is we call those the kind of the big three global online travel agents. Among that group, within this alternative category, Airbnb has over 50% share. So we expect all three companies to be successful, but Airbnb's share has actually been ticking up over time. And we don't see any signs of that changing. Airbnb is synonymous with the category. And then, of course, the other big player that you have to mention is Google. Google is really important to people doing research for their travel stays. They haven't had as much share in the alternative accommodations, vacation rental space as they have had in hotel, but they're certainly increasing their feature set. So that's something to watch out for. The more success Google has, the more companies like Airbnb and Booking Holdings have to spend on advertising. When it comes to the hotel companies, we really expect them to stay in their wheelhouse, which is hotels. And they've you've seen Marriott, for example, launch a program, a partnership that allows their customers to book some homes on the site, but nothing that would even remotely threaten Airbnb. And then when you look at other companies that you mentioned, like Sonder, most of those companies are actually they're actually getting some of their traffic from the Airbnbs and Vrbos. So you don't see them as direct competitors either.
Good research here. Cowen analyst Kevin Kopelman joining us for our call today. Have a good trading session. breaking news that just crossed our desk, at-home fitness player Tonal announcing that NBA great LeBron James is now an investor and brand partner of the company. James will appear in Tonal's new advertising campaign as well. Joining us for our first on Yahoo Finance interview is Tonal's founder and CEO, Ali Oradi. Ali, good to see you again here. Pretty big development for you on LeBron James. How did you score him? Because James is notoriously picky on who he invests with.
Ali,
there you go. I'm sorry, I thought you were on mute. Go ahead.
No, thanks. It's something we're extremely excited about. The relationship with him started about 18 months ago when he first joined Tonal as an investor. And how it started isn't all too different from other athletes who've invested. We have about 20 to 30 professional athletes who've invested in our business. And the story is always they got a Tonal, they used it, they fell in love, and then they wanted to invest. And over time, we've just built that relationship. And being someone who works with equipment basically his entire career, has been around fitness his entire career, when he sees something like Tonal, adaptive digital weights, something that's incredibly efficient, something that's incredibly data-driven, he had to use it, and a partnership made perfect sense. He was excited about it, and we were able to make this happen.
Ali, you see the list of athlete investors you have, Steph Curry, Drew Brees, Serena Williams. Is LeBron now the biggest athlete investor in your company?
LeBron is definitely he's without a doubt one of the greatest athletes of all time. We're really, really proud to have him involved in the business. We're excited. He's excited. And the most important thing that I can say about this is he's been using Tonal to train. He actually believes in the product. It's something that he personally uses. He views strength as a foundation of greatness. And this is something that came up in a lot of our interactions with him. And being able to get stronger with the most advanced piece of equipment ever created is something that he's really, really aligned with. This is something that, of course, we've seen with the likes of Serena Williams and Steph Curry and dozens of other athletes who use the product for that exact same reason. And he's just adding one of the greatest athletes of all time to our roster, and having him be involved with us in this capacity is just a huge, huge step for us.
Hey, Ali, it's Julie. Obviously, when you get these folks sign on as investors, it's something that can potentially prompt more people to sign up and buy the product. How many people have bought the product? How many of these have you sold? And how has your sales growth been?
Well, we have not been talking explicitly about numbers in terms of dollars sales. But what I can tell you is we did last year announce that we grew 8x year over year, which is massive growth. In January of this year, we raised $250 million at a $1.6 billion valuation. And we've seen significant growth since then. And so when you're looking at those valuation numbers and the multiples that you would assume are behind them, you can extrapolate the rate at which we're growing and how many Tonals we're selling. I'm just going to tell you, it's a lot. It's significant.
Ali, do you expect some form of shakeout in this at-home fitness space? I see you guys, very innovative product, Peloton, very innovative product. But I see something like Amira, I would say not too innovative, and you see other competing type products out there. Ultimately, over time, is there just two major players in the space?
Well, we are the leaders in connected strength. We're also the leaders in intelligent fitness. One of the things that we did differently from everyone else in the sector is our aim to bring a personal trainer into the home rather than just a group fitness experience. We did that by bringing a lot of data to bear by building AI and personalization. And we really view that as intelligent fitness, not just connected fitness. So we're forging ahead, and we're leaders in multiple dimensions. We've built all sorts of moats around our business. We filed over 45 patents to date. Of course, there is one business that you mentioned, Peloton, which is significantly larger at this point, but we're growing faster than they historically grew. And then you're right. After that, there's a lot of smaller businesses who are building more point or niche solutions. I do expect that's going to shake out over time. I don't believe this is a winner-take-all market, but I also don't believe it's a market where we're going to have room for a dozen different players.
And Ali, news out today that Apple is having trouble just getting components for its iPhones. I mean, how does your supply chain look in this environment?
I'll just tell you, it's a lot of work to secure supply. We've tripled the size of our manufacturing team just in the past 12 months. And the 12 months prior to that, we 10x our manufacturing capacity. We brought a second factory online last year, bringing another factory, a third factory online in the next few months. And a lot of this is just about securing material, securing capacity, keeping supply chains moving, and logistics, just moving product around the world and across the country. It's hard work, and it's where we're making a lot of investments. The vast majority of our investments are either going to marketing, brand, operations, or content, where you might have heard, but we recently announced live content on our platform as an addition to the many forms of content that are available to our members.
And Ali, I know you've been asked this before, and I'm going to ask it again, what the IPO plans are. And if you're not ready to IPO now, sort of what you're looking for, what would be the trigger? What would be the thing that would mean that you're ready to go there?
Well, we've been building towards it. In the last 6 months alone, we brought in a number of new executives into the C-suite, and operations, product experience, technology. And a lot of that is about readying the company for an IPO. We still have a lot more building to do in terms of, operations, finance, infrastructure, and a lot of the compliance things that you need to be public, but it's something we're working towards every single day. We're going to look for that moment in time where being a public company is beneficial to us and is not a distraction. Being public can often take a lot of management energy, and right now we're growing so fast that we just want to focus on, supporting that growth rate. And really supporting our member base, which is incredibly passionate about our product. We have a net promoter score that is pretty stable at 85. We have the highest engagement in the sector. And those are metrics we certainly don't want to lose track of just to become public. We'll become public when we can, pull off being public, tap those kind of public capital markets, and make sure that our business is solid throughout the entire process.
Well, we'll see you back on Yahoo Finance when that big day happens. Tonal founder and CEO, Ali Oradi, good to see you.
Mindbody has agreed to buy ClassPass. Now, Mindbody is a platform for booking workout and health classes. ClassPass is a subscription service to book workout classes and other types of classes for that matter. So now the two are coming together. Financial terms not disclosed here, but we're joined by Josh McCarter, Mindbody CEO, to talk about the deal. Morning, Josh. Tell us about how these two are going to integrate. I'm someone who has used both platforms, and so I'm curious for the users now what that experience is going to look like.
So with Mindbody is best known probably for our B2B application. And from that lens, for the businesses that use Mindbody, there's not going to be a lot of differences. Now, what we're looking for on the consumer side is for those Mindbody businesses that don't participate with ClassPass, that will now be able to offer more of their inventory if they elect to participate with ClassPass. We also have a very large consumer marketplace with Mindbody where millions of consumers are searching and booking for classes, but it's not a membership product and it's not at a discount. And so for those consumers that are looking for that variety through a membership with discounts, then we also hope to be able to offer that to the Mindbody consumer base as well.
And so for the sort of B2B offering, as you're trying to incentivize more of the Mindbody customers to become ClassPass clients as well, are there various incentives you're going to be offering? Are there ways that the two are going to be working together that are going to make it more attractive for people to also sign on to ClassPass?
Well, the number one thing that we're looking at right now is more of a product integration so that aspects of ClassPass can appear within Mindbody's core operating system. So think about the dashboarding and the performance results and information on class pricing and utilization and so forth. Fourth, ClassPass has a depth of knowledge around this and some very intelligent tools they call smart tools that we're looking at bringing some of that data and information into the core product. And we think just by doing that, that it'll be a much more compelling proposition than just standalone marketing that most of the wellness space uses today.
Josh, when I first saw this deal, I couldn't help but to think when Facebook bought Instagram, is that a valid comparison?
Yeah, I think it is, because also in that type of a transaction, there was a desire to keep a very strong brand and keep the teams in place. And so as we look at the complementary aspects of the businesses, 97% of MindBody's employees are focused on our B2B operations, whereas 100% of ClassPass's team is focused on its B2C. So we really see the opportunity to continue investing on both sides, both in B2B and in B2C. And the $500 million that we secured from Sixth Street as part of this acquisition will certainly enable us to do that.
Right. And Sixth Street, known for investing in companies like Airbnb and Spotify. Looking at some of the numbers here, 9 in 10 of the top activities right now booked on ClassPass are for in-person experiences and classes. I mean, ClassPass definitely struggled during the pandemic, right? There wasn't anywhere for people to go, and a lot of people paused or canceled their subscriptions. So besides that figure I just cited, give us sort of a state of play of what ClassPass is looking like right now in terms of engagement.
Yeah, so I would just first start with the broader industry. I mean, 90% of consumers are looking to get back to in-person classes as soon as they're able to, and 80% of consumers are saying that wellness is more important than ever. So what we see on the ClassPass side is that when a market has reopened and subscriptions have been reactivated, ClassPass actually proactively pauses subscriptions versus the consumers doing that. And so as they're reactivating and they attend one class, then they start attending more classes at 110% of what they did pre-COVID. We also see on the MindBody side through the B2B lens and the transactions that run through our system that on average, when a market reopens, the businesses are booking above their 2019 levels. So we really see the surge back into in-person classes. And that's why, as you mentioned, 9 out of 10 classes on ClassPass are being booked in-person versus virtual now.
Josh, this is a pretty, it just became what looks to be a more compelling business here, a more compelling business to potentially pitch to public market investors. When's the IPO?
Well, right now we just made the announcement and we're looking at working on the integration plans. But obviously the story here is a better together story, faster growth for the businesses, being able to expand, being able to look at industry consolidation, and certainly looking to get back to the public markets at some point. MindBody was taken private by Vista Equity Partners in 2019. And now we have additional PE backers, including L. Catterton and Temasek and Apax, with ClassPass's investors coming into MindBody's cap table. And we're certain that at some point in the, in the not too distant future, that we'll be looking at a return to public markets. But as of today, we just don't have a line of sight on the timing for that.
And Josh, I also wanted to go back for just a moment to the ClassPass sort of shrinking and then re-expansion here in terms of engagement with users. ClassPass also cut a lot of staff during the pandemic because the business shrank. How many staff has it brought back, and is it at its pre-COVID levels in terms of the number of folks?
So it's not at its pre-COVID levels yet in terms of headcount, but it's close to 400 people. So it's a very large, very large business, and it'll be joining a team of MindBody members that are 1,500 strong around the world. And right now I'm actually coming to you from the ClassPass office in New York City. So it was great to be here and meet some of the employees and many that have been here for 5 to 7 years. So it's really nice to see what's going to happen with the cultures when we bring these teams together.
I think that calls for a group team workout, Josh.
Excellent. I'll have to ditch my jacket for that.
Definitely. Yes. I think that probably would be a good idea. Josh McCarter is MindBody CEO. Let's keep in touch, Josh. Looking forward to talking to you again.
Welcome back to Yahoo Finance Live. We are watching a lot of the names in the shipping sector, as of course we've been highlighting some trouble there when you think about how COVID has impacted everything, anything you want to ship in today's day and age. And UPS has seen a nice pop here today after Stifel upgraded the stock, about a 4% pop here, as analysts there point to a potential 20% upside despite all of the issues right now in the shipping space, saying the UPS is in a position with their disciplined capital allocation strategy to perhaps capitalize on all the opportunities there. And for more on that, I want to bring on the analyst behind the report. Bruce Chan is Stifel Transportation Logistics Analyst. He joins us now. And Bruce, when we look at the opportunity there, 20% upside, walk me through what UPS is really best poised to capitalize on. As we know, it's been a challenging year for a lot of these companies.
Yeah, thanks, Zach. I appreciate you having me on here. So I think you said it, right? Right now, it's a challenge for anybody that's shipping goods. But if you have capacity, if you have service, if you have an ability to try to correct some of the supply chain imbalances that we're seeing right now, we think there is a good chance to benefit. So when we talk about the upgrade, it's really been premised on some of the conversations that we've been having with investors over the past couple of weeks. There's been a lot of focus on, I think, some of the ground volume comp issues that we're seeing against very strong last year. And then also a lot of talk about the labor cost pressures, which we heard about on FedEx's Q1 earnings a few weeks ago. But we think that some of these concerns are misplaced, at least to the extent that the stock has traded off in recent weeks, because we've got a really strong yield backdrop right now. Despite what's going on with the volume comps, we've got a strong fundamental growth story for e-commerce here. Obviously, a lot of supply chain pressures, driving activity in the industry. And finally, we think UPS is not subject to the same types of pressures that FedEx is right now. So to the extent that you saw that sympathetic trade-off, we think it's a little bit overdone, and the investor should have a good opportunity to own a very high-quality company here.
Yeah, Bruce, I don't think anybody would argue that volume is an issue right now when we're talking about so much needing to be processed because of the backlog we're seeing across the board with logistics companies. My question is really whether, in fact, UPS is best positioned to meet that kind of demand. If you think about some of its rivals, everybody's sort of in the same position. How do you think things set up for UPS going into the holiday season?
Yeah, that's a great point, Akiko. And I'd say that UPS is in the best position, or at least one of the best positions. And there are myriad reasons, but I'll name a couple. So first, when you're looking at the kind of supply chain disruptions and backlogs as we are right now, there are a lot of shippers out there that really need to move product, and they need to move it right away. And the way you do that is through high-speed, high-service networks, which, of course, UPS is one. FedEx happens to be one as well. But the big shippers out there, I think if they're trying to get products on store shelves before the holiday season, they're probably not looking to do so via slow boat, literally. They're probably not looking to do as much through rail. Again, they're looking at high speed, low latency services. When you look at FedEx and UPS side by side, for the 1Q earnings for FedEx, they've got a lot of labor throughput issues right now. That's a function of where they are, we think, in their ground hub automation investment cycle, and also due to some of the peculiarities of their non-union labor force. So, of course, UPS has a higher labor cost structure with their Teamsters employees. Close to 80% of their workforce is Teamsters. But that also means that, their employees have been seeing steady wage increases over the last several years. They're some of the highest comped, employees in the parcel network out there. And that's helped the company to attract the labor that it needs to service the demand that we're seeing right now.
Yeah, it's pretty surprising to see in your report highlighting the fact that UPS almost double the margins on small packages relative to FedEx. So they definitely have an edge there. I guess, when we think about the pressure now, though, right, and we're hearing reports of retailers, Walmart, Costco, stepping up to commission their own shipping, their own ships to get stuff over here. I mean, I wonder what that does to kind of a UPS, a legacy, a provider of logistics here. I mean, is there any implication there longer term and maybe, risks around the thesis?
Yeah, it's a good question. And it's one that we've been hearing a lot with Amazon as well, chartering planes, mm-hmm. Implementing its own long haul air fleet. We think that, this is more of what all of these companies have been doing for a long time now. Walmart has long insourced its own baseload capacity, most particularly with trucking, but they still have upwards of $2 billion in freight spend. So, there's a certain amount of baseload capacity that they can haul on their own. It makes sense for them to haul on their own. But, there is a ton of stuff around the fringes and with other shippers that are, certainly much smaller than the likes of Lowe's, Home Depot, Walmart, Target, and Amazon that need to be moved. So all of these companies can charter ships, they can buy containers, but it's very difficult to operate a network of the size, scope, and scale of FedEx and UPS. Amazon can buy a few planes here and there, but FedEx and UPS each operate, over 400 aircraft apiece. And that's something that is not easily replicable, at least not within the confines of our, price target time horizon.
Bruce, what does the labor picture look like for UPS? I mean, we always hear about ramping up hiring going into the holiday season, but here we are in October talking about a labor shortage. How big of a concern is that? And the additional or the increase in wages that are likely to have to come, does that increase the risk in terms of cost increases?
Yeah, absolutely. And we are modeling cost increases. We're budgeting for high single digits in terms of wages through the next couple quarters. But, you know, this is something that UPS has been doing and FedEx has been doing actually, too, for a long time now. You know, we saw the first big step function in holiday e-commerce rates back in 2013. And since then, you know, they've built very good infrastructure for bringing on these seasonal workers. For UPS, that number is something around 80 to 100,000 workers. And again, we're not saying that there are no labor cost pressures for UPS. We certainly think there are going to be. But, you know, I'd point to two things. So number one, these are not to the same extent that FedEx is seeing right now, which is, you know, labor issues in its fundamental baseload throughput. So, you know, they're having to reroute their network. They're having to, you know, alter the structure of their network because they can't find the core workers they need. This is not just an issue of, you know, higher wages for seasonal workers like we expect for UPS. And I think the second important point, too, is that we've got a very, very strong yield backlog, so or backdrop, excuse me. So while we do see these wage pressures, we think that, you know, UPS should be able to recapture them through price increases. And you've seen these accessorial fees come through in a big way, just as we discussed with the airlines and with the restaurants a few minutes ago.
Yeah, it's an interesting, I mean, all of this year has been wild to watch. And you know, the upside here, very interesting, 20% upside. We'll see how it plays out. Bruce Chan, appreciate you coming on here to walk us through the thinking behind it. Stiefel Transportation and Logistics Analyst, thanks again for the time. The team behind the scenes here, raving about some of the points made there.
Coffee is having a new moment in the sun on Wall Street in recent weeks. Dutch Bros saw a strong response to its IPO. Analysts have come out bullish on Starbucks into earnings. And today, we shed light on a formidable competitor to both of those names, privately owned Caribou Coffee. The coffee chain, which operates 718 locations, says it's ramping up franchise development as it looks to expand to more states. John Butcher is Caribou Coffee's CEO and joins us now. John, good to see you this morning here. So how many locations are you looking to open over the next year?
We don't have a defined target for our franchise goals, but we will continue to expand our company-owned development rapidly. And our focus on franchise is finding the right partners. I don't need a million partners. We need sophisticated operators that care about the same things that we do.
And so how are you finding those folks? And are you finding a lot of them? Is there a lot of demand right now?
Well, we just launched on Monday. We just actually announced our franchising endeavor. So you guys are hot on the case. Conversations are ensuing. There's a lot of interest, and we're currently in the vetting process.
So many mixed trends, John, at this point in the pandemic. You know, what are you seeing in your business in terms of traffic and sales?
Our sales have been really strong throughout the pandemic. Our teams are incredible. You know, they've been faced with 1,000 different challenges, but they've been resilient. The business has been sound. Traffic is up both to last year and to 2019, or I should say sales are up to both of those. Traffic is still somewhat erratic, depending on the type of store that you're operating. Drive-thrus are performing exceptionally well. Non-drive-thrus, especially in densely populated urban areas, are still challenged with not as many office buildings full, but the business is doing great.
And as we know, to sort of dig into that a little bit, breakfast was really challenged during the pandemic because not as many people were going out for breakfast. They were drinking their coffee at home. So when you look at different day parts, are you seeing a lot of that flow come back? And geographically, are there certain areas that are stronger than others?
Well, Julie, you're right. Breakfast shifted a lot during the pandemic. But one thing that is always the case is people need their coffee. So luckily, especially for Caribou, we're positioned to meet that demand wherever it is. So we have a thriving grocery business. We're on grocery store shelves in most states. We ship our coffee in K-cups to all 50 states. So if it was at-home consumption, we could meet that demand. But a lot of people showed up to our stores and our teams were absolute just heroes throughout the entire pandemic, you know, serving first responders, showing up to make sure that the people in the community that needed to be fueled got their morning cup of coffee and then some.
There are two major chains in this country, John. You have Dunkin' Brands, you have the beast that is Starbucks, but I look at you and I look at Dutch Bros that just came out, very successful IPO. Why do you think
some of these smaller chains have been able to compete with these two behemoths?
Well, I think for Caribou, you know, it's really our focus on people, on our product quality, and on our purpose statement. I mean, back when our company was founded in 1992, our original founders said we want to eradicate crappy impersonal service from the industry. And so we started to hire people differently based on being others focused, believing that we can train them to do many of the roles. Our product is the best. We are the only national coffee house to serve 100% Rainforest Alliance certified coffee and espresso. And all of our beverages are clean label. So for us, that means absolutely no colors, flavors, preservatives, sweeteners, nothing. It took us many years to develop that. But if you come to Caribou and get a mocha, there's three ingredients in it: coffee, well, espresso, dairy, and chocolate chips, you know, because we could just believe that real ingredients taste better. And then our purpose, I think, resonates. It resonates with our team. It resonates with the people that come to Caribou on a daily basis. And that's to make people's experiences so great that they spark chain reactions of good throughout the communities that they serve. So I think for us, we stay so close to what our customers want that our flat organization can continue to meet those needs faster than maybe some other companies can.
I'm going to refrain from poking fun at our producer, who loves putting gallons of Oatly coffee in her coffee. We'll leave it there, though. But talk to us about staffing. Talk to us about staffing, John. Can you get the workers you need right now to support the demand you are seeing in the morning hours and of course, through the drive-thru?
Well, I wish we could say we were immune from some of the staffing challenges. We're not. We always see fall turnover when students go back to school and work. But what we've seen is that the inbound applicant flow is less than it typically is. And I think there's a variety of reasons for that. But for the most part, our team is faring pretty well. We have the extra challenge, of course, of having to staff the existing stores and then fuel all the growth that we have coming for the next couple of years, but we're ready. We have many of the next store managers already on staff. So we continue, it's just a daily battle, right? You just have to continue to get out there and share the story and find the exceptional talent in each of the marketplaces that we compete in.
So I hear you rolling out or getting more aggressive in opening new restaurants. I see a positive reception in the market to a Dutch Bros. Are you thinking about returning to public markets here with an IPO?
Well, I don't have any comment on any potential IPO. We are focused solely on continuing the momentum that we have at Caribou and then expanding through our franchise business.
All right, we'll leave it there. Good luck in the path forward. John Butcher, Caribou Coffee CEO. We'll talk to you soon.
Thanks, Brian.
Today, got a SmackDown coming for WWE SmackDown, a wrestling match to end all matches here as All Elite Wrestling faces off in primetime with WWE SmackDown for the first time. A very interesting back and forth shaping up for the battle in primetime. WWE SmackDown, of course, going to be on FS1, AEW going to be on TNT, and we've seen AEW add a bit of a pre-show to, further fuel the battle taking place and the overlap between the two wrestling giants. And for more on that battle brewing tonight, very happy to bring in the CEO of AEW. Tony Khan joins us here, of course, also a co-owner of the Jacksonville Jaguars, alongside Yahoo Finance's Reggie Wade, who, of course, is a big wrestling fan. And Tony, I mean, when we look at this, I'm sure you're licking your chops to get a chance to go up head-to-head with WWE SmackDown. But talk to me about what you're doing to maybe make it a no-brainer for fans out there.
Well, AEW right now, we're on a great run. We've had great shows. It's a little bit different for us this weekend. We have normally a Wednesday night show, Wednesday night Dynamite, and we have this great show we do every Friday, like we're doing tonight, Friday Night Rampage on TNT. And this weekend, because of a lot of sports on TNT, they've time shifted Dynamite to Saturday, which is kind of crazy for us because we've had six straight weeks recently where Dynamite's been the number one show on all of cable Wednesday nights. So we're on a great run. And now we're launching Friday Rampage, which has also had some great weeks and ranked as high as number one on cable a few times. So tonight's a huge opportunity for us. I was surprised when I found out we had head-to-head competition tonight because it's kind of a first. But we rise to these challenges, and we have the best wrestlers in the world and the best wrestling in the world. So AEW on TNT, I strongly encourage people to check it out. We've grown our fan base internationally and built a big audience also overseas and in Canada, where we've been the number one rated wrestling show, and in the UK, where every single week we have the most watched wrestling show at AEW. So tonight on TNT, AEW Rampage is going to be the best wrestling show of the Friday night for sure.
Tony, Reggie Wade here. On September 22nd, you guys went into Arthur Ashe Stadium in New York. And as I was pulling up to the show, the line stretched all the way to Citi Field, which is across the street. And there was just electricity and a magnetism in the air. And you love to see it as a wrestling fan. But my question is, are you leading a wrestling revolution, or is this an evolution?
Well, it's a great question, Reggie. First of all, thank you so much for coming to Arthur Ashe Stadium and being there for AEW Grand Slam. You know, we had a great event there, and because of great fans like you, we made it the most attended wrestling show in New York City in over a decade by any wrestling company, by anybody. It was a huge success to have 20,000 people there, including you, Reggie. It was a dream come true. And I think what we're doing, it's both. This is a revolution for the fans. That happens to be the name of our Q1 pay-per-view event, which has been very successful for us. And we built this big audience on TV and on pay-per-view, and have really evolved a business model, I think. I try not to oversaturate the pay-per-view world with too many shows. And when we do them, they're huge. So we've had 4 quarterly linear and streaming pay-per-view specials. Those have done really, really well for us. We do, like I said, 4 a year, and each of them are up year over year. So the Q1 pay-per-view is up year over year. Our Q2 and Q3 shows, Double or Nothing and All Out, now we've done those 3 times, and each year they've gone up. And our last show, All Out, which was just last month in Chicago area, it was right before that Grand Slam show Reggie was at. That was our biggest pay-per-view of all time. And it was the biggest pay-per-view done by any independent wrestling company, any company other than the WWE, since the 90s. We just sold over 200,000 units, over 205,000 worldwide, I think now. And it's been a huge success for us, thanks to great wrestling fans like you, Reggie. So thank you very much.
Tony, AEW has a stacked roster. How do you balance between the already established superstars, the CM Punks, the Bryan Danielsons, the Chris Jerichos, the John Moxleys, and how do you balance that with the Jungle Boys, the Darby Allins, the MJFs, the Sammy Guevaras? Is there enough room for all of those names?
Absolutely. That's what's great about the launch of AEW Rampage. Now we have 2 shows and more opportunities tonight, Friday night, live on TNT, and then also Dynamite, which is this week going to be on Saturday, but normally, you know, about 50 times a year, you're going to see on a Wednesday. And this just happens to be one of the rare occasions where we're not. But I am very excited about the opportunity. I mean, it's a great thing in sports when you have a very deep roster. And when you're in management, trying to manage that roster, as I have to, when you're booking the matches, it means you have to really take advantage of the opportunities you have. And to have another show now with Rampage on Friday nights has allowed us more opportunities. And also, you can do both. I mean, CM Punk made his return to wrestling on this huge all-out pay-per-view last month. He'd been out for 7 years. He is quite possibly the biggest name in all of professional wrestling. And it's been a huge attraction for us. And he came back against Darby Allin. And they had a tremendous match. Darby Allin's a young, exciting wrestler. And, you know, CM Punk absolutely put a spotlight on a young star. And Darby Allin's been a star for us. Yeah. He's been a longest reigning TNT champion and, you know, went into his 10th defense of the title. So we've had, you know, a mix. And MJF, who you mentioned, is really one of the young rising stars in wrestling of any age. Forget about the fact, you know, he's not even 25 years old. So it's really a great time for us.
Tony, we have to ask you really quickly about the Jaguars, an 0-5 record, bumpy ride since Urban Meyer took over. And you said that he needs to regain your trust and confidence when the viral video.
I didn't say that. My father said
are
that.
Are you confident that he can finish out the
Urban,
season?
You know, that was a statement my dad put out. I've spent a lot of time with Urban. I worked together really closely with him and, of course, with my dad. And I manage the statistics and analytics for the Jaguars, which, of course, for you here on Yahoo Finance, being numbers people, is really right up your alley. So what I do for the Jaguars, my father owns a team. I've looked for like undrafted players and try to use analytics to find efficiencies in the game. And I think we've done a good job of that aspect of the game. James Robinson is a player who I found using analytics and, you know, managing the undrafted free agent process. He's one of the players that I've overseen signing. But, you know, as far as what's been happening, we absolutely want to win games. And I'll leave it to my dad and Urban to make the statements on the rest of that.
Yeah, and of course, Urban Meyer making his AEW cameo earlier this year as well, which I'm sure the crossover there is likely to continue. But Tony Khan, I appreciate you coming on here and chatting with us today. AEW CEO, we'll see how the SmackDown battle goes tonight alongside, of course, our thanks to Reggie Wade as well.